This is Central Time. I'm Lee Rayburn in for Rob Ferret today. And coming up tonight at 6 on 1A+, India's prime minister has been in power for nearly 9 years. Now he's in hot water after censoring a documentary about his role in a series of deadly riots. That's tonight on 1A+, India's future. Now, major media companies have gone through more rounds of layoffs in recent months, while smaller local news operations have struggled just to stay afloat. It's creating a challenging media environment that leads to less coverage and lower quality information for consumers. It has journalists and advocates alike concerned about the future, so a group of them are teaming up now to try and do something about it. The newly relaunched Rebuild Local News Coalition aims to develop new funding sources and push for policies to support independent, objective journalism to address the issues facing the industry. And we want to hear from you at 1-800-642-1234. What's the local news like in your town? What do you see and hear about what's going on where you're from? Do you wish there was more coverage of the issues in your area? And how would you like to see local journalism supported? What can we do? 1-800-642-1234 or email ideas at WPR.org. Our guest is Anna Brugman. She's the Director of Public Policy for the Rebuild Local News Coalition. And Anna, welcome to Central Time.
Hello. Thanks for having me.
So for starters, who's all in this coalition?
So our coalition has nonprofit newsrooms represented by Institute for Nonprofit News, commercial digital-only sites, local independent online news publishers, weeklies, some dailies, rural weekly papers through a national newspaper association. It's a really broad coalition. There's Spanish-speaking publications and historic Black newspapers. Overall, there's 20-plus organizations that Rebuild Local News represents. And the idea is that we all work in concert together to advocate for public policies to support the future of the local press.
So what happened to the local press? Where did it all go? How did it lose its funding?
A long story, and it would honestly depend on where you began. I don't think we can start with the Industrial Revolution, but we'll put in the 1990s, I guess. So the internet was obviously a huge disruptor to local news. And again, there's many great journalism historians that have much more sweeping local news histories than this one. But the internet was a massive disruptor to the business model of local news. It used to be that you would put your classified ads or advertisements into a local newspaper. And that became a platform for local businesses and even larger businesses to advertise to consumers. But it's not been that way for many, many decades. And that led to a slow and then very fast decline of local journalism. 2008, the recession was very hard on many local newspapers. That's not to say that there isn't innovation in the local news sector. I don't want to paint the whole picture. It's very bleak. There's tons of innovation happening. Something like 30% of nonprofit newsrooms didn't exist 5 years ago. There's business model innovation happening at local newspapers and commercial digital-only sites. But overall, we have almost 60% fewer local journalists than we used to. And that's really because of a stirrup of the business model and also changes in reader habits. So again, I won't start at the Industrial Revolution, but...
But you could.
But I won't.
Thank you, Anna.
You're so welcome.
One of the news stories that I've seen recently is about the Department of Justice's antitrust case against Google, saying that they've got a corner on the market of online advertising. Is that part of the problem for local journalism?
It is part of the problem for local journalism. Platforms and digital ad monopolies are part of the problem, but I think it's a piece of the problem, not all of the problem. Anytime you introduce new technology into journalism, there's a huge shift. There's a transition. This happened when we introduced television. Newspapers actually started doing more analysis when television was introduced because they were no longer the source for quick information. When radio entered entered the journalism market, there was a huge stir up. There's always disruption anytime you introduce a new technology. And so to some extent, that was to be expected. The way that Google and Facebook have colluded to corner the market on digital advertising is a problem, not just for local news outlets, but for small businesses generally. So that is, again, a piece of the problem, but I wouldn't say pin all of the issue on that digital ad monopoly.
Anna Brugman, our guest, Director of Public Policy for the Rebuild Local News Coalition. And so what are some of these issues that this coalition is looking to take on?
Of course. And so we're looking at public policies that incentivize the hiring of journalists. And so the policy that we've been attending to the most closely in the last few years is something called the payroll tax credit, which sounds like the least exciting piece of public policy I could possibly imagine. But it is a very exciting piece of public policy. what it does is it provides a refundable tax credit to local news outlets that is calculated based on how much you pay your local journalist. And so this money goes to the news outlets. It doesn't go to the local journalist. And there is a cap on how much local news outlets can get on these tax credits. It was singled out and put into Build Back Better. Obviously, Build Back Better didn't pass. It was also included in the end of year omnibus in 2022. It got cut at the last minute, but we've been working very closely with this policy at the federal level. But then there are a series of other ones that we've been looking at the state and local level, refundable tax credits for small businesses to advertise in local media. And when I say local media and local news outlets, I'm not just talking about newspapers. I've mentioned nonprofits. Public radio is a great example of local journalism that this would benefit. You're so welcome. Commercial digital onlys. I use local news outlets very broadly, but the refundable tax credit to small businesses would incentivize small businesses to take out advertising in local news outlets. There's another one for subscribers. We're looking at municipal advertising allocations. So every government, city, state, federal, has an advertising budget for many of its projects like the Department of Health or or your city's recreational department. There's an advertising budget. And much of that advertising budget, especially at the higher end government you go, doesn't go to local journalism. And so New York City tried a program where a certain proportion of some agencies' budgets had to be allocated to community newsrooms. Chicago just passed it as well. So we're also looking at scaling those sorts of programs. Those are the ones that have been introduced so far. We're also really interested in something called replanting, which would incentivize the purchase of newspapers from large chains into local hands. And so ideally that would be like a local trust or a public benefit corporation, incentivizing local ownership and disincentivizing non-local ownership. I will say that that small business tax credit that I talked to was actually introduced in Wisconsin last year and had, I believe, 16 co-sponsors. Representative Novak was the lead co-sponsor on that. And so it's not just you know, the coastal states that are looking at this are states all around the United States that are interested in supporting their local press through public policy.
So how would you rebuild local news? 1-800-642-1234 to join our conversation. What do you see in your local newspaper? Or how about your local nonprofit news source that you'd like to give a shout out to and what we can do to support them? 1-800-642-1234 to join us or email ideas at WPR.org with our guest, Anna Brugman, Director of Public Policy for the Rebuild Local News Coalition. So Anna, if we're going to offer these payroll tax credits or offer tax credits at all for these local information sources, you'd have to make a case for the value for the rest of us or the value the rest of us would see in a robust local journalism. What's its value to me?
Oh boy, what a...
I know.
Again, where to start? So I guess I could start by talking about what happens when local news leaves. And we've studied this mostly by looking at when local newspapers leave. For a very long time in our nation's history, local newspapers have provided kind of like the foundation of local news sources. So much of what gets up to national broadcast or national newspapers starts as a local story. And so local newspapers have for a long time provided the bedrock of not only accountability reporting, but also kind of the that social capital, those ties to community, the community features that remind people why they care about their community. People who read local news are more likely to volunteer. They're more likely to vote. They are more likely to take interest in a civic cause. And so you begin to appreciate what local news offers a community by studying what happens when something like a local newspaper leaves a community. And what we see is almost every metric by which you would measure civic health or the health of a community trends in the opposite direction as you would want when you lose local news in a community. And so that's voting rates. That's the number of folks running for an elected position. Incumbents are more likely to win elections when local news leaves. Polarization increases. There's a professor, I believe he's at LSU, Josh Darr, has done a lot of research on how local news affects polarization. But government borrowing rates go up. Bond ratings trend the wrong direction. Government waste goes up. I could go on and on and on and on. It's even more likely that communities without local news will have environmental disasters because there's fewer people watching corporate interests in those communities. And so there's fewer people who are able to point and say there is corporate malfeasance that could result in an environmental disaster. There have been some that have posited that it's more likely that infectious disease will spread without strong local news. It's hard to, it's almost every metric by which you would.
So you basically, would, yeah, what happens without local news? You have no idea.
And I think that there's, I'm going to say his last name wrong. And if he's listening, I'm sorry, Tony. He's a publisher in Iowa. He wrote a paper after he graduated from a program called New Start in West Virginia. And he wrote that it's really hard to know which direction local news works in, whether it's a cause or an effect, but it is wrapped up into the economic health of a community. And so it's the economy, it's the government, it's civic life, it's pollution, it's health. I think a good way to think about it is like, when is the last time you cared about something in your community? When is the last time you were upset about something or found yourself feeling really proud of your community? And where did you read it? Where did you hear about it? And I'd be willing to bet a lot of money. but I'm a journalist, so I don't have that much money. So that should.
So not a lot to wager on that. We're talking with Anna Brugman from Rebuild Local News Coalition about the state of local journalism and efforts to support it. What would you do? 1-800-642-1234. What would you like to see? 1-800-642-1234. Or email us ideas@WPR.org. We'll continue our conversation coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Lee Rayburn, and we're picking up the conversation with Anna Brugman. She's the Public Policy Director for the Rebuild Local News Coalition with us today to talk about the challenges facing local journalism outlets and some potential solutions. And you can join us at 1-800-642-1234. Would you pay for more local news if a tax credit was available for it? 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. And Anna, Tom in Milwaukee called in, couldn't stay on the line, but wants to know if there's any relationship between your organization and public broadcasting or just print media. What are some of the groups that are part of this coalition?
Well, hi, Tom in Milwaukee. We work very closely with public media. National Public Broadcasting isn't a member of the coalition, but we work very closely together. And we make sure that any policy that we are advocating for is what we call platform neutral or medium agnostic, which means that as long as folks hire local reporters, as long as you're transparent about your ownership, and as long as you're not owned or majority funded by organizations likely to have political motives, and you're probably local journalism, and you should probably be supported with any public policy. And so that's public radio, that's print, that's nonprofits, that's commercial digital onlys. We really are focused on the local journalism and who is likely to do that local journalism more than just the medium at hand.
And is there a name for the federal legislation for a payroll tax credit for media outlets?
So that was originally proposed in something called the Local Journalism Sustainability Act, which was introduced in 2021 for the second time. It is bipartisan in the House. It has a pretty broad spectrum of co-sponsors on that. And so if you look at the Local Journalism Sustainability Act, there are three pillars, which one is the payroll tax credit, one is the advertising tax credit, and one is the subscription tax credit. And so the payroll tax credit was singled out in Build Back Better, but was originally introduced as that big bundle of policies.
And Anna, if I'm a news devourer, not just a news consumer, but I just can't get enough, what more can I do to support the information, to get more information? What role do I play in this?
And so if there is a high quality news outlet in your area, support it, whether that be your public radio station, your local newspaper, your local nonprofit. I subscribe to a combination of all of those. And then you can support organizations that are trying to help other local news outlets. And so that's folks like American Journalism Project or Report for America, which our founder, Stephen Waldman, also helped found. American Journalism Project is in venture philanthropy. It's a very innovative organization that's working to kind of shore up the business side of local news outlets. Many of our members, in fact, do take donations, and they would be very excited to see more donors supporting their work of supporting local journalism. Report for America is a really interesting, full disclosure, did work for them for a little bit, organization that places local journalists in local newsrooms that otherwise wouldn't be able to afford them, kind of similar to like Teach for America or AmeriCorps or the Peace Corps, but for local journalists in the United States. And so you can look for these organizations if you're looking for a way to do even more than just subscribe to your local news outlets that you feel provide high quality journalism for your community. You could look at those organizations to support as well.
Let's go to your calls and questions now at 1-800-642-1234, where Pat in Green Bay is standing by. Pat, good afternoon. You're on the air with Anna Brugman, Director of Public Policy for the Rebuild Local News Coalition.
Good afternoon, and thank you for taking my phone call. You know, I'm all for this public support, or I don't know. I'm sorry, your person that you're talking to, I can't keep up with her. She's very, very quick. But anyway, all I want to say is, you know, it's all good, but we need to do away with where we have one news source that's slanted towards the Democrats, one that's slanted towards the Republicans. That shouldn't have anything to do with the news. The news should be the news, not what corporate America wants us to see.
So how do we keep the partisan away from the information when it comes to journalism, Anna?
That's a great question. And I am sorry, I speak very quickly. I'll try to slow it down a bit. The qualifying language in a lot of the public policies that we're pushing, it does not have anything to do with the content that is produced. And so in terms of how public policy could enhance a perceived partisanship, we are actively, that is a pillar of our approach to pursuing public policy, is making sure that's not the case, is that no government official would be able to pick and choose which newspaper or news outlet would benefit from a specific policy. And we do that by constructing qualifying language that is more about the characteristics of a newspaper or a news website or a public radio station. Do you hire journalists? Do they live in the area in which they covered? Are they funded by, are they not funded by politically motivated folks? In terms of the journalism that is done, the public policy is actually, we intentionally distant from that because it would be a nightmare to us as journalists to pass policies that undermine the independence of the local press. That's our worst case scenario. And so I think that it's important to have conversations with your local newspaper and local journalists. Local journalists are people. I've been a little local journalist before. we're humans. And we would love to have a discussion with the folks that we cover about how we can improve our coverage. And I think that, I think part of that is what happens in the conversations we have with local journalists and our local newspapers. And our role in that is making sure that we have sustainable and thriving and vibrant local news outlets in all communities that can be a voice for the community. So I think that's our role in it.
And we've just got about a minute left here, Anna, but how would you respond to concerns people might have about the government being involved with regulating journalism or funding it?
Yeah, I think that's a real fear. And I think we don't want to disqualify that at all. And as I said, a major pillar of our policy pursuits is that they're content neutral, that we don't pass policies that put a government official in the position of picking which publications serve their interests. And we don't want journalism that serves government interests. As I said, the qualifying language, the definitions, the qualifying language, the really, really boring, wonky stuff is really, really important in these policies. And we think it's a huge responsibility to pass good journalism policy because we need more good journalism.
Yeah, the really, really boring stuff, which is what you do at the Rebuild Local News Coalition.
But we do.
Hey, Anna, thank you so much for joining us this afternoon.
Thank you so much for having me.
Anna Brugman is the Director of Public Policy for the Rebuild Local News Coalition. She was with us today to discuss efforts to revitalize local journalism through its advocacy. A note of clarity here, Wisconsin Public Radio is not part of the Rebuild Local News organization. Coming up tomorrow on Central Time, Rob Ferret returns with a look at what it takes to help refugees find a home here in the U.S. Meet the president and COO of the Welcome Corps. And you don't need to study harder or study more. You just need to study smarter. The author of Study Like a Champ joins Rob Ferret tomorrow. Coming up after the news, from jobs to exercise to school, we're using games, points, and streaks as motivation. And that isn't always a good idea, according to our next guest, the author of the new book, You've Been Played. I'm Lee Rayburn, in for Rob Ferret today, and you're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Lee Rayburn, in for Rob Ferret here on the Ideas Network. And coming up, the Biden administration says the COVID-19 public health emergency will come to an end May 11th. A doctor joins us to talk about what that could mean for COVID policies and programs. Now, games are supposed to be fun, but more and more we're seeing aspects of games used in the less fun parts of our lives, like work, school, exercise, even finance. And unlike games that are for fun, if you lose at these games, you can face real-world consequences. And you can't just insert another quarter to try again. This idea of gamification has been on the rise since the early 2000s. And our next guest thinks it has positive uses, but it often goes too far. We're listening back to that conversation now, and you can still join in by emailing ideas@wpr.org. Do you see examples of gamification in your everyday life? Does your workplace or school have a point system or some type of competitive aspect to it? Do you like it? Do you dislike it? Do you think it has impact? Let us know. Email ideas@wpr.org. Adrian Hahn is the founder and CEO of the game development company Six to Start. He's also the author of the new book, You've Been Played, How Corporations, Governments, and Schools Use Games to Control Us All. He talked with our own Rob Ferret last month. Here's a listen.
Can you start off with sort of a working definition of gamification? What does it mean?
Yeah, it's basically the use of ideas from game design, like points, badges, leaderboards, missions, that sort of thing, for non-game purposes. So for things like education, health, fitness, anything that isn't just about entertainment.
A lot of your book and a lot of our conversation are going to be about the misuse and abuse of gamification. But you don't think it's necessarily bad in and of itself? You use it, for example, in apps you've created. At best, what can gamification help us do?
Well, I think that gamification can help us achieve things that we know we should be doing or we really want to do, like learn a language or, you know, get fit or just learn new concepts, but we find it kind of difficult to do so or really tough. So I think one really fun game out there is called Kerbal Space Program, and it's all about learning physics and orbital mechanics by launching little creatures into space. And it's very accurate, and it's just a great way of learning science. But also, I think there's all sorts of fitness games. You know, a lot of people play Nintendo's Ring Fit Adventure. I used to play Dance Dance Revolution, you know, when I was a kid. And, you know, a lot of ways to make boring activities a bit more fun.
Now, let's stay with those self-improvement apps. I find, you know, I've got a fitness tracker. It gets me out going for walks. I do a language one. It keeps me motivated to keep my streak going to learn a language. That's great. But you say sometimes gamification is misused in those self-improvement apps for a variety of reasons. Where do we start to go wrong with those?
Well, it's interesting you mentioned streaks, because I think that's a really powerful motivator for a lot of players. So, you know, a lot of people use Peloton, a lot of people have Apple Watches, and a lot of these are fitness apps and games use streaks to encourage people to work out, you know, 5 days in a row, 10 days in a row, 100 days in a row. You know, you see people showing off their streaks and trying to maintain them even at the expense of their own health. You know, we know that it's not healthy to be exercising when you're ill. Even if you're not ill, it's just good to have rest days when you're running or swimming or cycling. And these streaks, you know, if they're designed in a really simple way, which is how most of them are, if they give people achievements for just working out forever and not taking any rest, they can actually harm you. And that's one example of gamification that is against people's interests.
Talking to Adrian Hahn, his new book is called You've Been Played, How Corporations, Governments, and Schools Use Games to Control Us All. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you use one of these motivational apps that uses leaderboards or streaks, say, or points to reward you and motivate you? Did you stop? If so, why? And how about at your workplace? Are there competitions, productivity challenges, things like that? What do you think about those? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 with your experiences or your questions for our guest. Adrian, let's go to work now. You spend a lot of time looking at how companies are gamifying for better and mostly for worse. First of all, what kind of things are out there if people haven't encountered this at work?
Yeah, so I mean, it's all over the place. I was amazed and kind of disturbed by how frequent it is. So a lot of people work in call centers now or in customer support, and their interactions with customers are timed down to the second. And if they are not, acting well, or if they're not, you know, being polite enough, or just responding quickly enough, then they can have points deducted. And they can slip down the leaderboard and not receive achievements. And if they do too badly in this kind of gamified system, then of course they can get punished and get fired. But I think one place which people will be pretty familiar with, one app, is Uber. And a lot of Uber drivers are having their compensation effectively gamified. So periodically, Uber drivers will be invited to choose from different quests. And in these quests, they can sign up to drive 30, you know, 70, 100 trips in a week. And if they achieve the quest, then they get more money. And if they don't, then they lose that. And of course, you could say, well, isn't that a good thing? You know, people like having more money. But if you talk to Uber drivers, which I've done and a lot of people have done, they find it kind of manipulative because at the end of the day, it's all down to money. And I think they'd rather have more certainty rather than having to hope that they'll be offered these quests and hope that they can really achieve those goals. I think what they'd rather have is just better pay in general. And it's really interesting that they choose to call these things quests, you know, rather than just tasks. And I think part of that is down to the fact that we're all used to thinking that quests and challenges and achievements are good things because we play video games. Everyone plays video games now. And it's really interesting and kind of a bit disturbing to see workplaces take those ideas from video games and try and use them in a way that can exploit people, I think.
Well, and you talk about what ends up being incentivized in that Uber driver's case, and then this can come up with certain truck driver systems too. The incentive might be keep driving, even though you might feel too tired to keep driving. Ultimately, the incentives can lead us in potentially dangerous directions.
Well, exactly. I mean, I you know, people from Uber are on record for saying that they want drivers to drive as much as possible. Obviously, they would say that they don't want people to drive dangerously. At the same time, you know, it's not just quests that Uber uses to try and manipulate people. There's all sorts of things, that tricks in the apps, gamification they use to try and get people to move to different areas of the city or just to drive more. And, you know, I think that these systems can work in incentivizing people through money or just through visuals to try and get them to do more than they wanted to.
Now, you also look at use of these apps in schools, and I'll get to one of those in a minute, but one of the most amazing quotes from your book is a New York Times article about a classroom game app called Class Dojo. A third grader quoting here, "I like it because you get rewarded for your good behavior, like a dog does when it gets a treat." I mean, that third grade kid, he says a lot there.
Yes, this was one of the most eye-opening things I discovered while researching the book. This comes from an app called Class Dojo, which is used in supposedly 95% of US schools, and it's in schools around the world. And it basically does two things. The first thing is pretty simple. It's like a private social network for teachers, students, and parents, and that's fine. But the second thing is basically, it's an app that gives teachers the ability to reward and deduct points from all the students in their class in real time. So they can go and say, oh, if this kid is acting up or being too noisy, minus 10 points. If they're being quiet, if they are doing teamwork, then plus 20 points. And those points can often be traded in for treats. And again, you know, this is not a new thing. We've had points and we've had badges in schools before. But as that kid says, you know, there is something about the kind of continuous nature and also about the way in which this app works just from an audio point of view, which is really interesting and really different. So in Class Dojo, when you get points deducted, you hear the sad sound from the phone, from the teacher's phone. If you get points awarded, you get this happy sound. And, you know, the kids obviously associate that, you know, with being trained like a dog. And now, of course, you could say, well, this is good if it keeps the classroom under control. But really, is this the way that we want kids to learn in school, to be motivated in school? And I think that's a big question. Some people might say, actually, that's fine as long as kids behave. But I'm sure that a lot of parents would think otherwise.
Let's bring on a caller at 800-642-1234. Peter is with us in Racine. Peter, what did you want to tell us about?
So I actually work as a software developer for a manufacturing company, and we use scoreboards like this, the gamification, to motivate workers and to try and, you know, have them work off of each other. It isn't used to alter their pay or anything like that. It's just used to evaluate and address issues where performance does fall or where performance is exceptional. It's one of those things where, in my opinion at least, it's all about the ethics of how it's implemented. You don't want to do exactly what Uber's doing and encourage
Peter, can I ask, how long has this been in place at your workplace?
Some of the scoreboards have been in place for 8 to 10 years now, and some of them we are implementing. It just, you know, every time we find a place where we can utilize it, it's great, but you have to be able to compare people on very even terms, and when you have different roles that don't mesh with each other, it's very hard to compare them.
Interesting. Peter, thanks so much for sharing that with us. Adrian, what do you think of Peter's example?
Well, I think it's really interesting because we've always had examples of giving feedback to workers and in workplaces. And I think that makes a lot of sense. You know, people want to know when they're doing well and when they're doing poorly. And it can be nice having that feedback in real time. I think it really depends on scale. You know, it's hard for me to know whether one case or another case is done well. Certainly in some big organizations, one of the problems that we have with these gamified workplaces is that the only way you get feedback is through this computerized system, this gamified system, and there is no way really to talk to a manager. And it is being done in such a kind of fine-grained surveillance way that even if you slip up once, then that's it. And so that's obviously, I think most people would agree, that's just too cruel. Now, I think there are ways to do this in a way that isn't that doesn't punish people so much. But it really comes down to those rewards and punishments. You know, if the punishment for slipping up a couple of times is you're fired or you're docked pay, then, you know, that's too much. But if it's just, hey, we're going to have a chat, then that's probably okay.
Thanks a lot for sharing that with us, Peter. We're talking to game designer Adrian Hahn about his new book on gamification. It's called You've Been Played, How Corporations, Governments, and Schools Use Games to Control Us All. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you, like Peter, have something like this going on at your workplace? What do you think about it? How about in your school or your child's school? Have you used Class Dojo or some other behavior reward app like that? What do you think about that? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll continue the conversation here on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We continue our talk with Adrian Hahn, founder and CEO of the game development company Six to Start. His new book is called You've Been Played, How Corporations, Governments, and Schools Use Games to Control Us All. You can join in at 800-642-1234 with your questions or to share your encounters with streaks or points or leaderboards at your work, your school, your exercise app, you name it, 800-642-1234. Back to your calls now. Kevin is on the line in Janesville. Hi, Kevin.
Hey, good afternoon. I'm a teacher. I have used these points-based systems with students on multiple occasions. Honestly, I do not like them. I think they are teaching kids the wrong idea of doing things for points or for not losing points. And until they internalize that this positive effort leads to positive consequence, they're a very poor crutch. Thank you.
Kevin, thanks for sharing that. Adrian, that gets to the heart of a big question here for students and others. What is our motivation? What should our motivation be for doing something like behaving and learning in school?
Well, exactly. I mean, I think, you know, he's drawing a distinction between extrinsic and intrinsic motivation, you know, where extrinsic motivation would be just trying to get someone to do something by effectively, you know, bribing or rewarding them with sweets or points or trinkets. And, you know, intrinsic motivation, you know, is where we want kids to learn English or learn science because they find it interesting or they find it, you know, engaging or they find it, you know, beautiful. And of course, you know, it's not always the case that kids are going to pick up on that immediately. And it's difficult to do that if you've got, you know, a huge class and you don't have a lot of time to prepare. So I do sympathize, you know, with teachers who do, you know, end up using Class Dojo. I think a lot of them probably would prefer not to. And I think it's a weird situation where I think some kids and some parents actually expect Class Dojo to be used in some places. But, you know, the problem is if you rely on it too much, then the only thing that the kids are trying to do is maximize points. And, you know, that only works for so long.
Thanks for the call, Kevin. Wendy joins us now in New Berlin. Wendy, hi.
Hello, Kevin. You just summed up exactly how I feel. I'm a retired teacher, and I got my degree in the 70s, and I think that makes a difference. So I found so many teachers doing these money programs or tokens, and I didn't do it. In fact, I fought against it by doing things like I would bring in a whole tray of chocolate chip cookies, and my students would be like, whoa, what'd we do? You know, and I'd say nothing. I just like you. And that was hard for them to get. It's really, I think it's really seriously a problem. It's scary to me how children are being manipulated, and it is much easier for the teacher, but good luck trying to break that system.
Wendy, thanks for the call. Well, for somebody like Wendy at a school, at a, you know, making decisions at a workplace, you name it, how do you break out of that gamification, negative gamification mentality, Adrian?
I think it's tricky because obviously, you know, if you're just one teacher in a school and you've got, you know, a lot of obligations, it's hard to sort of swim against the tide. Especially, of course, if you're a worker in, you know, Amazon, or if you're a driver at Uber, you know, maybe you don't have a lot of power there. You know, I think as individuals, then, you know, we can try and push back against gamification when we encounter it in our own lives and just be aware of when we're being gamified. I mean, to take, for example, I've got an Apple Watch, and every month it tells me to try and beat my previous month's calorie goal. which is, as you can imagine, it gets increasingly difficult to do that to a point where it's impossible. And it's okay to just turn that off, right? You know, if you see that in your life, if you have an app like Duolingo, or you have a watch that says, hey, please try and do more, you can just turn that off, because that's not something that you're asking for. I think in schools, yeah, you know, I think I love that note by Wendy talking about just, hey, I'm just giving you these cookies because I like you, rather than, you know, it's a reward or a punishment. And, you know, that's something I try to do in my own workplace, you know, with my employees. I think people like getting positive feedback, and they like getting, you know, learning about ways to improve. At the same time, I don't want to be in a situation where I'm just doling out points and badges every, you know, few minutes or every hour, as actually happens in some workplaces now. So, you know, if you're in a position of influence, then you can try and change things. If you're just someone who, if you're someone who works at a workplace, then you can ask them to change. But in your own life, I think there are places you can turn off gamification if you can.
Wendy, thanks for that call. I also accept chocolate chip cookies, if you like the show. Adrian, you're pitching messages to different audiences here. I want to focus on one: people who design apps and programs and workplace reward systems. What kind of ethical considerations do you want those people to have in mind as they design and then implement these kind of gamified setups?
Well, you know, I have a few different sort of like guidelines for how people can do it well. One guideline that I've mentioned before is really try and keep the rewards and punishments small, right? It's just not, it's not a good system if the punishment is you're fired or you're fined $10,000. It just makes people terrified. to be honest, it's not really a good motivator. And similarly, if you have a prize of $1 million, you know, $10,000 or free college or that sort of thing as the result of performing well in a gamified system, but people are just going to manipulate that. They're going to burn themselves out. They're going to cheat. It's not a way to motivate desirable behavior. I think another thing to do when designing these systems is ultimately to try and keep the customer or the players or the users' best interests at heart. And that is very hard to do. And sometimes, you know, people might say that's paternalist, but, you know, that's something that we try to do in our own games. We try to think, look, how can we design this in a way that people are not going to be unhappy at us for making them overexercise or unhappy at us at spending more money than they wanted to? And sometimes that can go against the profit motive. And that's just something you're going to have to decide. And not every designer can make that decision, but you can voice your opposition.
That was Adrian Hahn, the founder and CEO of the game development company Six to Start. He talked with Rob Ferret last month about his new book, You've Been Played, how corporations, governments, and schools use games to control us all. Coming up after the news, we talk with a doctor about the end of the COVID-19 public health emergency, set to end May 11th. What will that mean for you and me? I'm Lee Rayburn, in for Rob Ferret, and you're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network.